Support for KMUW's Into Music podcast comes from McClelland, reminding listeners that Frank Sinatra coined the word skibbity in Strangers in the Night, which you can listen to in their downtown Wichita showroom. More info on McClelland's innovative sound, lighting, and video technology can be found at maxsound.com.
Hi, I'm Jed Bodwin, and you're listening to Into Music from the KMUW Studios, part of the NPR Podcast Network. My guest on this episode is George Usher, whose latest release is Stevensonville. It's a collection of 12 songs, each written about a citizen of the titular town. The packaging finds each composition accompanied by full-color illustrations from Lori Weber, as well as lyrics. All of that is also collected in a 28-page booklet. The LP was conceived over 30 years ago, but financial fears over mounting a live production as well as manufacturing costs meant that the project was set aside despite it being twice performed live. Stevensonville recalls literary works such as Edgar Lee Masters' Spoon River Anthology, Thornton Wilder's Our Town, and Sherwood Anderson's Winesburg, Ohio. On it, Usher is joined by an impressive cast of musicians, including David Mansfield and Andy York. The LP was produced by Tony Shanahan, and we recently spoke all about the making of Stevensonville, as well as the importance of holding on to creative ideas that you truly believe in. That's George Usher on Into Music, coming up now. So one of the things that I love is that you have these songs that have these, you know, they're based on characters or they explore characters who have these rich inner lives, secrets, that sort of thing. But the nature of the way that everything's presented, we're able to see a much deeper story emerge.
The love song in the piece is a woman who's in love with the thing is, it's a true love song. If you just take, if you just listen to it, it's Annie Dunn. All the songs, by the way, are titled by the characters, like a Spoon River conceit. But she's singing, she's in love with Elvis Presley. But if you look at the illustration, there were rats in the illustration. So that's just sort of a conceit to throw in there. And all of the illustrations of Elvis that are on her wall are fat Elvis. Even the Jailhouse Rock picture, he's fat Elvis. That's the joke, is that she doesn't care about whether he's fat, whether he's thin, whether he's whatever. She loves fat Elvis, period. She doesn't care. And that's the love involved. You know what I'm saying? It goes beyond whether or not you want to argue his Sun records were the best, or you only like him for his movies, or you only like him in his 70s period when he was fat. She loves him fat forever. You know, that's the true love involved in the song, even though you might say that's a little iffy. If you see the illustration, you know, that's where I say the illustration sort of confers on the, you know, on the song, and the song confers on the illustration, you know. Or the one Jack Green, it references a Twilight Zone episode. There's a Twilight Zone episode called something like The Monsters on Maple Street or something, and it's about a lot of neighborhood people trying to get into the neighborhood bomb shelter. It's a famous episode in pop culture. And the idea is everybody's trying to get into the local bomb shelter, but there's only so much room, and everybody turns into a monster trying to get into the local bomb shelter. Well, we had a bomb shelter in our neighborhood where I was growing up. You know, we had an actual bomb shelter in somebody's backyard. You know, I got to see it and everything. And the trick with this particular guy, the Jack Green bomb shelter, is that he's ranting and raving about not letting anybody in his bomb shelter. But if you look at the illustration, nobody's trying to get in. He's ranting and raving from inside. He's got his poor family stuck inside the damn bomb shelter, but nobody's outside it. I'm just saying, if you actually take the time to read the lyrics, look at the illustration, think about it, that there are different stories going on here that sort of where the illustration informs the viewer beyond the song itself.
I love that idea of the bomb shelter, because it's like when I was growing up, I remember the the fallout shelter signs, like the IGA up the street from our house. That was the place, and it had the sign, and I remember seeing those, and then just like one day they were all gone, right?
Right. Well, this guy was apparently, I found out later, because he was the father of a friend of mine. At the time, this would have been late 50s when they built the bomb shelter. It was still there in the 60s. But he had apparently in the 50s been like, he had a title, like local head of civil unrest. They had a name for him. Like in case the Russians came into Lakewood, Ohio, they had a name for him. Like he had an actual title, and that's why he had like the one bomb shelter in town, because it was like the prototype, and then he just kept it into the 60s. You know, I remember looking inside it. It was pretty sad. As far as bomb shelters go, it was just like a few shelves with some old tin cans on it, you know, some gas masks. It wasn't anywhere to play.
But that idea, too, of like the people really aren't trying to get in. It's sort of like that thing like with gated communities, right? Where it's like, are people really going to just like come up to your house and knock on the door? And you know what I mean? Is that really going to happen? Or you just...
Well, they seem to... Well, back when the Twilight Zone episode was written, which would have been late 50s, I think they thought that it could, that there could be, you know, sirens go off, and then where do you go? Do you dive under a desk?
Yeah.
I guess the place that you were supposed to go was the school or the basements or something. But if somebody had an actual bomb shelter, that was supposed to be better than, you know, going to your basement or something. So I guess it had extra cachet in that thinking. You know, I was very young back then, so
yeah.
I'm not quite aware of what the Red Scare was like back then, but people were afraid, you know?
So I was less aware of Spoon River Anthology and more aware of Winesburg, Ohio, Sherwood okay. Anderson. And that, right, is it's small town, short stories that add up to a novel, and the characters kind of speak. So when I heard the record, that was very familiar to me, and just kind of the secrets that the characters carry, and the, you know, the quirks and the beauty within them that doesn't seem in the outside world, you know. But you know, it's one of those things where it's like, okay, because there's a certain economy to that. In a way, you know, you're talking about it's a relatively short album, but then you know, you begin to see the unity, right? And that thing that no matter how much we think we're different, we are at times more alike than we think and expect.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah, we think we're really special, and then it turns out we're just like the neighbor. And with Stevensonville, it starts out in one part of town. It starts taking you through the town, and it stops to look at a couple of or a few different individuals, and then it ends with a character who's actually leaving the town, and having the strength to sort of journey out on his own, and that's sort of the lesson in a way. That's The thing you want to take away the most from Stevensonville, I guess, is just the notion that you know, you want to, you don't want to be held down by the people or the experiences that surround you. You want to be able to sort of break free and be a butterfly. A lot of people, I think, just are too afraid to break out and try something new or do something different or follow their dream or their heart, wherever that is. And I think that a lot of the anger, this is just me blabbing, a lot of the anger that people have in the world today, if you just step back, it's just that they're not really happy with how their lives have sort of turned out. And a large part of that is simply that they haven't sort of taken chances or taken steps in directions that might have made them happy.
Well, and I think too,
they've got to blame somebody, so they blame people that they see are outwardly happier.
We get upset if what happens isn't the ideal. Like, I'm sure, like, when you left Ohio and went to New York City, you had an idea of what it might look like, and then it probably differed, but here you are all this time later talking about music and having made music that's still a part of your life, but it might not look the way that you thought it would. And we have to allow ourselves that, I think, you know?
Well, for me and people of my generation, a little bit older too, for my generation, I mean, we all, people my age and a little older, I can say, I think with almost impunity, that most of us saw Ed Sullivan and said, I want to do that. But we couldn't all be the Beatles, you know, but that it was sort of the idea, and that was shortly reinforced by the Monkees. It was sort of just an idea that you could have a wacky life with three or four of your friends and, you know, be the next big thing. And you take that idea, and some of us have a certain amount of talent, and some of us have a certain amount of ability to work with others, you know. I mean, having a foursome like the Beatles is like once in a eon, you know what I mean, that those four came together. And yet that inspired so many people that formed bands, and they, all of us found out, well, it's not going to be that. Whatever my career is going to be, it's not going to be that. And all of us had to either make adjustments for, well, I'm going to make it what it is. I'm going to do this. I'm going to leave this out. I'm going to leave that out. And then as the years go by, you make adjustments because you decided early on, I want to follow music, or I want to follow being a writer, or I'm going to be a performer. Now I'm through with performing, but I'm going to continue to write, you know, whatever it is. If you wanted to be creative, you know, you find a way to do that. You know, it's like I said when I was here in the 80s, you know, I came here, I formed a band, we put out an indie 45, we played the places, but, you know, it wasn't making it overnight. There was no such thing. And so you have to, suddenly you find yourself playing in other people's bands, learning their songs, you make connections, you do things, suddenly you find yourself on tour with some other band, you toured the world, you've done this, you've done all kinds of different things that other people never had a chance to do. And you're making your own albums on the side, and you do the best you can with them. And then 30 years later, a friend says, what record would you like to make? And then you make the album that you had really wanted to make 30 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, and here it is. And you've got a, you know, that your illustrator has has their show the same week as your performance, and it's bringing all your old friends together. At least, you know, it's a wonderful life in a way. You don't have to, you know, you don't have to have 10 million sellers. You know what I mean? if you're creating and making music or making art with your friends and with people that you understand, and you're helping them do their art. That was one thing I enjoyed, is that in a lot of the bands that I was in, I was able to sort of be the second guy, you know, the guy who sort of was second in command, so that the singer or the songwriter could sort of keep his shit together, and I would keep the band thing together. You know, I would, you know, keep the rehearse the band or make sure they were all ready to go on stage, be the second guy, the guy singing harmonies, or the second guy taking solos, whatever it was. You know, if you can make the other guy look good, that's a great job too.
This whole thing, I think, is that reminder of, like, if you got something that you feel strongly about and you feel is special, no matter what, don't let it go, you know?
Right.
I mean, I know people who, you know, they wrote a screenplay when they were 16, and at 50 they were finally able to make it, you know?
Right.
And it's just that thing of, yeah, go ahead.
If you believe in it, if you believe in something you've done, you just keep it to the side there, and there may come a time when you can use it. And you know, and you, and you know, I was a little concerned when I sent out the, like I said, I took a recording from the Bowery Poetry Club that I'd done, and that was the demos that I taught the band, here's the record we're going to be making. And I had to decide for myself, are the songs still valid? Mm-hmm. Are the lyrics still valid? Do I have to change anything? And I was looking at them, you know, because I didn't go to the players and say, oh, hey, these songs are all 30 years old. Are they still valid? You know, do these songs stink? You know, are these, you know, sophomoric, you know? And everybody loved the material. They were wild about the material and were very surprised and very supportive when I told them that it was actually older material. And they were, you know, totally behind it. You know, but that's the thing, which is that there's a song of mine that I wrote back in like 1981. And that was an indie 45 for my little power pop band back then that was playing CBGBs and everything. And this song, so how many years ago is that? 45 years now? And this song follows me to this day. And every so often, somebody else, nobody ever big enough to really, you know, do anything massive with it. But every so often, somebody covers it, you know, out of the blue. And, it, you know, the biggest, it's a song called Not the Trembling Kind. And the biggest momentum I had with it was a country singer named Laura Cantrell recorded it in about 2001 and made it the title of her first album. And it made a big splash, got her a major label deal, and John Peel's big favorite song, and I don't know, you know, he's an English DJ, and she closes all her shows with it, and you know, other people, so a lot of people know it. It didn't actually splash for me, but other smaller artists have performed it just because they like it. And so I, you know, even now today, people will cover it, you know, because I did it, of course. And you never know with a song like that. 45 years later, somebody else might cover it. You never know.
You've been listening to a conversation with singer-songwriter George Usher. His latest album, Stevensonville, is out now. You can find out more about it via Usher's Bandcamp page, georgeusher.bandcamp.com. You can learn more about this podcast and all programming on our station by visiting our website, KMUW.org. Send us your questions and comments at info@KMUW.org and find all the latest programming notes on that website as well. Thanks again for listening. We'll see you next time. And as always, we'd like to remind you that our theme music is composed and performed by Torin Anderson.